Are we doing okay?
Oh, yes, yeah, we're doing fine. When did you first meet Carl Florey? I think you said the Baker Lecture.
I tried to meet him. I think I have to go back to my thesis. My thesis with Frank Long was on the sorption of vapors through polymer films. Now, how he came about that, he had done some work in the war, and this was sort of an interest, and that's what the support was. And one of the things, although the prime emphasis was on the kinetics of the process, you wound up with an equilibrium sorption, and consequently you calculate activity coefficients. And these were the films we were using were cellulose acetate films. There was a very new theory then called the Florey-Huggins theory. So this was, say, about 1946 and a half or 47 that we started to get some data. And this stuff wasn't fitting at all. And then I noticed at an ACS meeting in New York around that time, I can't remember the year, maybe 47, that Florey was giving three papers. So I listened to the papers, and I tried to talk to him. So this was a problem that was bothering me. I was rather a precocious young lad, I guess. And I think, well, hell, this whole theory of his was all wrong, and he and I would have a little talk about it. But he was always surrounded by a large number of people, and I couldn't get really to. I was precocious, but also very polite in a way, so I saw him for the first time, but never really got to meet him. I met him for the first time when he came to give the Baker Lectures. And that was in the spring term of 1948, as we just refreshed our memories.
We'll come back to that, but sure. Were there any other student colleagues at the graduate level in those days?
There were a few. I was thinking about this the other day, and I'm sure I'm going to forget some. There was a fellow named Bill McDevitt, who started with Kirkwood and switched to Frank Long, because he couldn't go to California either. And he finished perhaps maybe a month or two after I did, about the same time, and he went to work for DuPont, and I think spent all his days in DuPont and recently retired. There was a fellow working with Lynn Horde, who did X-ray crystallography, whose name was Seymour Geller, who I remember taught physical chemistry undergraduate, was a crystallographer, who's a very eminent one, and particularly a boring crystal structure. Boron chemistry. And Seymour went to Bell Labs and a few other places and wound up at the University of Colorado, where I think he still is. There was a organic friend of mine, Lou Verstendig, Verstendig, who worked with Johnson, and he went to work for a company, went to work for Chevron, and then came east to work with a small company. Those were the people whose names as a graduate student. Well, then in Long's group, there was Paul Drexel, who went to work for Hercules. And there were, unfortunately, I might mix up the postdocs and these a long time ago, but in the graduate days. There was a fellow, Ken Coffin, who was from New England, who worked with Simon Bauer, who married one of Frank Long's graduate students. Her last name was Dunkel. I can't remember her first name. And they went to work at Cleveland, at the big NASA lab in Cleveland. And those are the people I remember. Those who I remember mostly over this time frame.
You received your PhD in 49.
Yeah, in June 49. Yeah.
You stayed on, but had you given thought to move to looking elsewhere?
Yeah, well, at that time, last year or so, I decided that what I had to do is go out and get an industrial job and make money. Frank Long was very much opposed to that. He tried to. We've been talked about this about the second, the third year when with him in the second year, and he said you ought to go do a postdoc somewhere. And he wanted to send me to Yale to work with Raymond Fuas, and I kept saying no, I didn't want to. Well, strange as it may seem, in 1949. Well, two things happened. I really got interested in what Florey was doing. But again, this whole idea of postdocs was a whole new concept. And strange as it may seem, in 1949, J. jobs. There were jobs, but there weren't jobs that I had. I remember. I think I had two jobs. One of which I offered. One of which I remember, which is one that was in Tonawanda, New York, working on inorganic phosphorus. And I just couldn't see. I forgot the name. I think it was a carbide subsidiary. I can't remember the name of the company at that time. I had another offer of the same kind, and I just couldn't see. Really, I wasn't interested. I mean, last thing I was interested in was inorganic chemistry. Where, I mean, a lot of people are, and there's nothing wrong with it. I wasn't interested in it. And then Paul Fleury had come to Cornell that academic year, and Frank Long told me he was looking for postdocs, and he knew me from the Baker lectures, and if I were interested, Long would. I mean, I think they had it rigged ready, or had talked about it. But if I was interested, he thought that he would talk to Paul Fleury, and maybe. And so my wife and I decided that maybe we better give this a shot. And that was probably the smartest, from a professional point of view, decision I ever made in my life. But as I say, there were jobs, you know, choice jobs, and jobs that you might be interested in, didn't seem to be, at least for me, very much opportunity. 49, 48 were very bad years. I mean, in terms of, as you know, chemistry, even, you know, 16 months ago, 18 months ago, my phone was ringing off the hook for companies wanting to hire people. Now my phone's ringing off the hook for students here, there, people are not looking for jobs. So I, that's the way chemistry's always been, I guess. This was that way at that time. So as I say, this is what I decided to do, and so we started in mid-June or July 1949. And I say this was, if I ever made a decision, that was a good one. That was that one. And I stayed with Paul through the end of 1951.
Was this your introduction to polymer crystallinity when you started working with him?
Yeah, well, I mean, my introduction, well, I should go back and say that when I finally got Fleury at the I use this as a very often as an introduction to my giving a talk, when I finally got him to talk to him during the Baker lectures, and one of the lectures, of course, one of the subjects was the Fleury-Huggins thing, and I said, look at all this data we have, and I could get down to his office, and he says, well, he says, Leo, the reason it doesn't work is that cellulose acetate's crystalline. Well, of course, I didn't know what he meant, and then some people say I'm still trying to find out. and that was the, but what happened, he had when I went to work as a postdoc, he had two basic supports. At that time, I already began to know how things were starting to work in academia. He had come, well, I guess it had been set up for him. He come with the old rubber reserve project, that Speed Marble, and you read about this, the reconstruction finance that was still going, and Peter Debye had a big chunk in. And he had a new grant from the Allegheny Ballistics Laboratory, which was making propellants for the government and were run by Hercules. And they were very enlightened management there, and they were interested in learning some of the basic properties, and we did a lot of work then on cellulosics, and went back to cellulose derivatives, not nitrous, one piece of work on nitrous cellulose, and that's how I got introduced into the crystallinity. I did two sort of things when I was at Cornell. Fleury published a very basic paper on crystallinity in 1949, a theoretical paper, and the substance of it, or the issues of it was, is melting crystalline free to a phase transition. And he had already indications from work had done at Goodyear. You know, he came to Cornell from Goodyear. Some work on polyesters that indeed it was, and it was my job not to say it was, but to find out more, look more at melting points, and the effects of diluents, the effect of copolymerization, things like that on melting points, and doing a fair amount of work with cellulose derivatives, but being able to branch into other polymers. And recollecting in those days, there was no linear polyethylene. Branch polyethylene had just been sort of come along. I mean, they had it during World War II, but it just was, its properties were just coming out in the literature in those days. And so one task I had, or one sort of general assignment, was to see from what we could do, say, experimentally, whether there is or not. Because as he told me many times, you can set up a theory to go either way, depending on what you feed into it. And he was pretty well convinced that this was the way it was, but then it did turn out to be that way. So one of the things we accomplished from just a straight experimental point of view was to show that we did indeed had a bona fide classical first order phase transition. And the other thing along the crystallization line that's of some interest to me is we started playing, if that's the right word, or exploring crystallization kinetics. But one of the things Fleury let you, if he thought you had anything at all that was halfway sound, he at least let you go and try it out for a while. And so what we did, we were doing our melting temperature work dilatometrically, which is a pretty, we're going back to doing some of it now, it's a pretty good classical way of doing it. So as you did the melting, it seemed sort of interesting to me, say, let's see how these things crystallize. So we'd take them from the melt, and we'd stick them at some temperature, and we had a whole bunch of constant temperature mass. And the other thing that Fleury believed in, he had a small group, and he believed that, I guess they did, I'm just looking back, if his postdocs were any good, he got them assistance. So I had a couple of assistants, one to start with and go as, you know, he didn't give it to you all at once. Mm-hmm. And so we had these baths, and he also gave me one time one of his graduate students for a summer student to be paid on the grant. And that summer, we worked out pretty well the melting process, and it was getting to be sort of routine. You had to decide what polymer to make your diluent mixtures, and it all took a lot of time. So once we had a good sample in the dilatometer, particularly the pure polymers, we just look at the inverse process. And this was in 1950-51, it's a long time ago. And then we found this fantastically strong negative temperature coefficient. In other words, if we were close to the melting point, nothing happened. And if we went down a few degrees, it would start to go, and 10 to 15 degrees would go very fast. And I must say, it certainly puzzled me. And I would say, if he were here, he would agree, if you remember, that it puzzled Paul Fleury. And we were sitting on this, and then I did it on polyethylene oxide, and he said, well, I'll try it on some polyester, and then I tried it on polyamide that somebody had made, and it worked the same kind of thing. And until we became aware, about 6 months before I left Cornell, less than that, of Turnbull's work on the nucleation of mercury droplets, this is a very interesting thing, did we really understand what we had. And the reason, the way we learned about Turnbull's thing was he gave an ACS tour lecture at Cornell. And in those days, they were at the, they used to be at the evening. And so one night, I noticed this is about 6 months before I left, 5 or 6 months before I left. We were out there, and you know, this Cornell wasn't a great big place. And so we went up there, and this guy, I don't know what the, see, you got to remember, in the usual physical chemistry curriculum and polymers, and even this classical, concepts of nucleation never come in. If you go back and look at your textbook, you have to look far and back at the end of the book if you find it. And here's this very nice lecture on droplets of mercury and the temperature coefficient and what was happening. And Fleury comes by to me, he says, let's get together with Turnbull tomorrow morning. And it became abundantly clear what we had. And then we did a few more experiments and I did the analysis, and I took the stuff with me and wrote it up when I went to the Bureau standards, but it was perhaps an interesting example. I suspect we would have found out sooner or later, but it may have been later, as to what we're dealing with, because not in his experience, and certainly not in my limited experience, had we ever run across nucleation phenomena, which has this very characteristic. So I think that I could say pretty clearly or fairly that we were the first to quantitatively establish the important role that nucleation processes played in polymer crystallization way back in 1951. Papers came out, I think, in 52, 53. There were two papers prior to really knowing anything else about things. And I wrote the papers up very early on when I went to the Bureau of Standards. But that's back to your question. That's how I got introduced to the crystallization, and these are the kind of things. We also did some other things which I think were important, which I don't do much recently, and that's we do the work on solution. I did some work on solutions. Not we did. There were a lot of things going on in the lab, and I did some work on solutions. At that time period, 1949-50, he had been doing a lot of work with Tom Fox, and I'll mention some of the people who were in the lab if you want to later. And their major focus was on the relationship of intrinsic viscosity to molecular weight and the thermodynamic nature of the solvent. The intramolecular excluded volume effect, the theta temperature, things of that sort, were the kinds of things that were evolving. And he and Fox had published, I think they had started, the lab was functioning when I joined it. I think they had started some of this work at Goodyear. Fox came with Fleury from Goodyear. They were publishing, of course we had preprints of the papers, and he made sure everybody knew what was going on in the lab. And so they had all this nice set of papers. There's a Fox-Fleury set of four or five papers, 1949 and 1950, in the JACS on the viscosity relations to molecular weight and the intramolecular excluded volume effect. And he was teaching, Floyd was teaching a polymer course one term. Of course, I remember he asked him, could I sit in on the course? He says, oh, don't waste your time. You know everything. So I didn't. And one day he came back from his lectures with a book under his arm. He says, you know, Leo, I think that the sedimentation velocity might be treated the same way as Tom and I had, Fox was still there, but he was involved in glass temperature work and a lot of other things, the same way that Tom and I treated the intrinsic viscosity. So my first question was, what's sedimentation velocity? And he said, well, why don't you read this? And it's a chapter in a book by Svedberg or somebody. And so we dug through the literature, I did, and it did turn out that you could treat the sedimentation velocity the same way you did the intrinsic viscosity. And then we found out that you can combine the sedimentation velocity with the intrinsic viscosity and have essentially a universal behavior and a set of constants then that were universal to all chain molecules. And what was interesting is that there was a young instructor at Cornell, Harold Chiraga, who was just, well, he came, I think, in 47. And what they were having at Cornell then were polymer seminars at night. Maybe there were 10 people, professors and students, 12 people, interested in polymers. So maybe every other week we'd meet and have a seminar. And I got to meet Harold, and he got to learn, hear about what was going on, what we already call these hydrodynamic, these flow properties. And he sort of suggested to me maybe we could apply these ideas to the hydrodynamic properties of proteins. And so we did. We set out to look at this, and it didn't take very long because it wasn't really that complicated. And we were able to do that, and we worked out what is known now in the textbooks. I'm not bragging, but it's there, the Chiraga-Mandelkern equation for the sedimentation, viscosity, what you. And the other thing that was, and so we were actually, Harold called me up one Sunday morning about 7 o'clock after we were talking, said, I think I see how to do it now. And he likes to work pretty hard. And we'd asked Flory to join us as a co-author, because we'd been talking to him on and off, and but he never, it wasn't, you know, the idea was between Harold and myself, and he would just say, well, this sounds good, or I keep going, or something like that, or pat us on the back. And then he was a senior person, I guess 99 people out of 100 would have said, sure, stick my name on. He said, no, you did it all yourself. And so we had a lot of battles with the referees, but we battled it all through. And so I just thought I'd mention, Harold and I are, and our families have been friends since that time, which is, what we say, 40 years ago. So it's a...
Yes, I think that's picker number 12 on your list.
Oh, you have a list there. Okay, yeah, that's consideration of the hydrodynamic properties of proteins. Yeah.
1953.
Yeah, okay, that was done, actually, you see. The work was done while I was still at Cornell, and there was about a year's battle.
Really that long?
With the ref. Oh, yeah, I had to go back to Cornell with Harold, and with Albert Noyes was the editor of the JACS. And boy, Flory one time said, you want me to interfere? And we said, and we were two young kids, we said, no, we're going to do this ourselves. And of course, we were having a real, somewhere is a correspondence that anytime I get discouraged with anything, guys, let's look at that, because that was actually a good lesson. And there was a lot of entrenched feeling and a lot of misconceptions. And also, we obviously were very naive, very green, and the paper maybe not has been as clear the first three versions until we got it right. But Noyes, I would suspect that maybe he was checking behind our back with Flory, but he would say, well, come back and have another go with the referees. And we finally figured out who the referees were, so we could then respond, knowing that we could see where they were coming from and respond and you know, to things. So it took at least a year, no, before we got the referee stuff. So that's why it came out in 53. We actually did the work when I was still quite well. Yeah, that caused quite a stir in a lot of circles. But that was part of the work that we had done, and to say, was this sort of an open lab, so we just took these trends that were in the lab. And
was this part of the resistance to the whole concept of polymers that developed even earlier than that?
No, this was not a development to the concept of polymers. This was a resistance, I don't think it's proper to surmise who the referees were. But I think this was in part their not understanding. Now, they become pretty ardent, actually. And also there was a whole school that had very strong vested interest in a certain kind of idea of how you treat a solution of a protein. I think it was a combination of that, and mainly that they didn't understand the polymer stuff that we were doing. Now, that's understandable. It was very, very, you know, new. Because I think that... once they understood it, and there was no problem. And I think part of it is that we were sort of green, and we didn't write a very clear paper. But I just remember a noise being tolerant. I know I wouldn't. I mean, he just let us come back and said, as long as you want to keep making a stab and revising it, I'll be with it.
You were actually spent 3 years as a postdoc.
About 2.5.
Long time?
Two and a half years. No, it was two. It came in June, July 49, and left at the end of 51. So it's
okay.
Yeah, that maybe in those times, it's about a good time. I know most of the postdocs between 2 and 3 years is a... Well, the problem there was, well, first place, Paul Fleury treated us financially reasonably well. So we didn't make any money, but we weren't starving. In fact, is when I took my first job at the Bureau, I went there for less money, a little bit less money than I was making it as a postdoc. And it was very exciting times. I mean, it was hard to leave. I mean, it was very hard to leave. I mean, I realized I had to leave, but and I'm glad I did leave. And you know, some people stick on and on and on. But if I have a good postdoc here over the years since I've been here, I'll tell them after they've been here 6 or 7 months and I feel that they're good ones. I said, well, unless something unusual turns up, somewhere between 2 and 3 years is a good time to stay, because you really get cranked up and you can develop sort of your own reputation, and you learn and mature a lot, and it helps you then. No, it was hard to leave. I mean, I'm sure that I could have talked Fleury to let me stay another year or two, but I felt time was coming. But we weren't hurting in the sense that we were able to make ends meet, because I forgot what the pay was, but it was about $400 or $500 more than I made my first job at the Bureau of Standards. But he was fairly liberal. And he gave you help in the lab, and it was very nice. And no, it was very hard to leave.
Did he come into the lab every day?
Well, I don't know if he came in every day, but he was very close. Oh, yeah. He'd come to the office. But you felt as though you had no problems. If you knew he was around, if you just stuck around long enough, he'd talk to you more than one time. I mean, he always kept his group small, at least in the days of Cornell and out there, so that there were Bill Krigbaum, Tom Fox, myself with the postdocs, Alan Schultz, I was a graduate student. I think there was one other graduate student that drifted away from Polymers. I forgot his name. So I think he never had more of 4 or 5 people, either total students and postdocs, working with him in the days of Cornell. So,
did you socialize at all?
Yeah, he used to have parties at his house. And Cornell was a very congenial sort of place, and we got to know his wife, and she was very helpful in terms of helping us with our little child at the time. And she was very pleasant, and he had a boat. He would invite us out to me and other people in the lab to sail some afternoon. So we had picnics, and we kind of... Cornell in the wintertime is pretty hard to do anything, but I remember one Christmas we were... Although we don't celebrate Christmas, he knew we were in Ithaca by ourselves, and he said, "Why don't you come over Christmas afternoon? We'll have something to drink." And he showed us some movies, and it was very... I remember it was a nice wintry day and that snowy day. And I put the chains on the car in those days, but he was in that way. He was very, very nice. He was nice all around. Very, very. What's the right word? Not demanding. High standards, really wanted excellence in everything. And you learned how to do an experiment, because if you had something, even if it substantiated his theory, you said, well, let's try it this way to see if it's right. And very, very, look at, not the man, but in the sense of really wanting to be sure of everything, a perfectionist, that's the right word. He sat on stuff until he... on theories and stuff, and even experiments, until we did it this way and that way, and then got another fraction and extended the molecular weight range. And that's the way you have to do things, and I still think there are a few people who still do it that way. But perfectionist is the word, very demanding in that sense. Not demanding that, you know, you snap a whip at you, or that I got misquoted or misunderstood in an article in Chemical Engineering News. It was demanding in the sense of being perfect, doing everything right. And so he told me, as I found out, he said, "You work all you want. I'll tell you, I can tell if you're working or not." And I tell that to my students here. You don't have to stand there and hold a whip over them. So in the sense of really wanting to be excellent, I mean, he really, really, in all the people who are closely associated with him, he really developed in us a passion for excellence, I can say that. I don't know if we've achieved it, but he certainly got that instilled in us. And I think that taking away what he did scientifically from a... that I think is his hallmark, is I would say, is a passion for excellence.
The position at NBS, how did that come about? Did he ask you give you the advice you give your students, or did you decide to leave on your own?
No. Well, we decided. In terms of leaving, we sort of mutually decided that And jobs were not too bad at that period. And and working with Flory, you know, we got a lot of interviews, and you visit a lot of places. And I had a job offer. Well, I went down to DuPont, and they had two jobs. One was in the newly developing polyethylene terephthalate fiber group that they had there, and one was in this place that they were going to run for the Atomic Energy Commission. I was not interested, but at Savannah River. And I've forgotten which one they offered me, but I was seriously considering it when he told me that L.A. Wood, who was a was at the Bureau of Standards, was one of the early pioneers who did anything quantitative in polymer crystallization and polymer transitions, was looking for somebody to replace somebody there, and maybe I ought to think about the job going there. And I thought about it, and the pay there was a heck of a lot less than the DuPont, but again, it was not. And he explained a lot of things to me and strongly urged me to go to the Bureau of Standards.
So he urged that position?
Yeah, well, I mean, he and he recommended me, obviously, for it very strongly, and so that's why I went down there.
And you had a number of papers, of course, that you were writing after you left Cornell.
Yeah.
Did you continue any work with him at the same time? Or
no, we essentially did not formally collaborate, as far as I know, except, well, I wouldn't say that. At that time, we certainly did. I haven't checked over the publication list. There was one time, there's a paper we have where my very good friend now, Malcolm Dole, had written a paper, which was all wrong. I know it's gone on tape, but please edit this out, okay? My good friend Malcolm Dole, very good friend Malcolm Dole now, who's quite a nice gentleman, had published a paper involving small-sized crystallites and their melting, which had some errors in it, let's say. And so Flory and I sort of recognized this where I was, and I probably called him up and so we wrote a small note. Now that, I think, there may be another... No, I don't think he was involved in any of the other things. That's the only formal work that I know of, except for the work we did at Cornell. Now, I may be wrong. I have to check the list, because when he came back from England, from his leave, he had published this very beautiful paper in the JACS on contractility and dimensions. That really got me excited, and I went up and I didn't understand it all, and I talked to him about it. And I think he may be on that first paper with Roberts and myself on the dimensional changes in rubber as a consequence of cross-linking. And that might be the only other time we actually formally collaborated, and we could check that. Where the idea was, if you stretched a polymer and cross-linked it when it was stretched, an amorphous polymer, or had it, then when you relaxed it, it would still have some length. And that was a very intricate kind of logic, and it was very difficult for me to follow. I remember going up to Cornell, and we just figured out how to do the experiment, and I went back and I did the experiment at the Bureau, and it did turn out to be. Right, I think that and the Doles, the thing about Malcolm Dole was just a small letter to the Journal of Polymer Science. We talked a lot and interacted a lot over the years on many things, but I think it's a formal paper writing system. My memory isn't so high, we'd have to go to the list, but that's my recollection. There are some things early on in the Bureau of Standards, but they were left over from Cornell that we were... Yeah, we worked very hard those days. We did a lot of work.
Yes, there's quite a number of papers. Yeah. Quite a number of papers that came out of that brief period.
Well, see, he also believed in having his students, his postdocs, work. You know, so I would work with Bill Craybaum together, or something, or with Jack Hensinger, and we would both be authors, but we each have made substantial contributions because they sort of naturally crossed each other. And he was a great believer in, at least I think he was. At least that's the way it came down.